Cuthbert Collingwood, if he were alive today, might be a stern but kindly headmaster. Old-fashioned in some respects, forward-looking in others, rarely adored but always admired, and with affection. If he was a hero, it was in spite of himself, and because of the state of the world into which he was born. That he was a remarkable man was recognised by all those who knew him well, and by a few others whose lives he affected. His closest friend, Horatio Nelson, 10 years his junior, saw in him all the virtues that made up the exemplary Englishman. Selfless devotion to duty, integrity, love of one's family, sense of justice, humanity, humour, and utterly fearless physical bravery. Collingwood was, in a sense, Nelson's ideal, just as Nelson himself was Collingwood's. Collingwood was far from perfect. He was grumpy and short-tempered, suffered fools not at all, was economical to the point of parsimony, and more than slightly pompous. He was a hopeless delegator, what we would nowadays call a control freak. His attention to detail was legendary. There is also an element of tragedy in his story, especially in his last years. And he disliked change, especially political change. But for all his conservatism, there is something remarkably modern about him. His decisions were always based on what he thought was right, and devil take those who cared how it looked. His leadership skills would have had modern management gurus nodding their heads with approval. His throwaway jokes are the stuff of stand-up comedy. I find it impossible not to like him. I hope that Northumbrians, who do not know him as well as they should, will come to like him too. For much of the 18th century, Britain was at war. So Cuthbert Collingwood, first son of a Newcastle trader, grew up in a warlike world. He was born in a house on the side, within a few yards of city walls which had been manned against the Scots as recently as 1745, and under the shadow of the new castle built by William the Conqueror's oldest son, Robert. Barely noticed these days, the side then was a busy, steep little street nestling below the medieval cathedral and Black Gate, its tall houses jutting out so far that it can have had little sun. In 1756, when Collingwood was 8 years old, Britain declared war against France. Newspapers of the time were full of the war. There were constant threats of invasion, rumours of plots and intrigue. There was also gossip from across the seven seas to be heard anywhere along the quayside, where ships of war, merchantmen and colliers were constantly coming and going. And just as children today play out their fantasies in computer games, boys of that era would have replayed famous naval engagements with their friends, as indeed sailors themselves did, using crumbs of bread and biscuit to represent ships on the kitchen tablecloth. The sea was a huge element in the life of 18th century Newcastle, but it was not the only element. Newcastle was above all a coal town, whose prosperity was beginning to reap civic benefits. A turnpike road to Morpeth had just been built by the corporation. New thoroughfares like Pilgrim Street were being laid out, and springs tapped to supply mains water to the town. Newcastle had its own bank. Wagonways laced their way across the countryside down to the Tyne to be met by keels, and across the region there was a buzz of engineering, industrial and agricultural innovation. Steam engines were being used to pump water from mines, and cattle of prodigious size were being bred on Northumberland's lush pastures. The first gas lights were about to be demonstrated in Newcastle. John Wesley came here to preach to large crowds and liked the place. If I did not believe there was another world, he wrote, I should spend all my summers here. And Daniel Defoe had long since described for a London audience the sight of mountains of coals, wondering at the same time where all the people lived who consumed them. The news was full of strikes and riots too. Keelmen struck many times for an increase in their wages. In Sunderland, a group of men who'd been caught by the press gang escaped and caused mayhem, and on another occasion the press gang themselves were committed to Newgate Prison for assault and other riotous behaviour at Ouseburn. This was Cuthbert Collingwood's world at the start of his 11th year, 1759. In the very few books which have been written about him, it is always said that he and John Scott, later Lord Eldon, the Lord Chancellor, were pupils at the Royal Grammar School, then a free school for children of respectable but poor families, supported by the town's corporation. It is true that it would be wrong to call Collingwood a product of that institution, because he was there for less than a year. He was taught Latin and Greek, and knew his Bible, but his later learning was acquired in the cabins of men of war. Collingwood's family was an old one, steeped in the Northumbrian countryside, but his particular branch was neither landed nor wealthy. An earlier Sir Cuthbert had been a famous border reaver, though more unlucky than successful, having been kidnapped by the Scots. The Admiral's father, also Cuthbert, had been apprenticed to a trader and then gone into business for himself, but he was not very successful. There was no naval history in the family, but they, like many people in a country where 5% of the male population were seafarers of one sort or another, knew naval people, even if they were not particularly well connected. A young boy thinking of the sea might have gone into the merchant navy, where wages were high and he might make a fine living in one of Britain's colonies. But this 11-year-old had other ideas. The year 1759 was the year of victories. Though the British army won a stunning victory over the French at Minden, it was the navy, forever expanding and protecting the trading interests of the empire, that seemed constantly in action. In the late 18th century, news was dislocated from events by a variety of capricious fates, tides, weather, accidents, and the speed at which ships could sail. Economic and military advantage was gained from the early arrival of news, and land-based telegraph systems would play a key role in intelligence during the Napoleonic Wars. But until the arrival of the steam vessel, nothing could overcome a contrary wind or tide. In June of that year, Admiral Hawke sailed with a fleet to the Mediterranean to join Admiral Boscawen in a blockade of French ports, and there was a report on General Wolfe's expedition to force a passage up the St. Lawrence River in Canada. A list of the French and English fleets at Toulon was published, and Collingwood, his younger brothers Wilfred and John, and their sisters too, would have learned their names, their captains, the number of their guns and their rigs by heart. Convincing nautical phrases like the weather gauge, hull down and 32-pounder would certainly have tripped off their tongues. But although the French fleet came out of Toulon, it sailed back in again without being brought to battle. In August, the French fleet in Brest thought the British were coming in to get them, but the roar of the gunfire they heard was only Hawke's celebration of the news of victory at Minden. But in the September 15th edition of the Weekly Courant, a Gazette extraordinary received by the Admiralty in London was published in full, bringing news the country had been waiting for. Boscawen's fleet had caught up with the French between Cape St. Vincent and Lagos, off the southwest corner of Spain, and defeated them in a major battle, taking 3 ships of the line and burning 2 others. Then in October came news of the dramatic capture of Quebec and heroic death of General Wolfe on the Heights of Abraham. And in November, Admiral Hawke came up with the French fleet off Quiberon Bay and chased them through dangerous shoals in a gale of shocking force, bringing them to action and defeating them decisively. 3 French ships were wrecked, 2 foundered and 1 was captured, her value, in accordance with tradition, divided amongst the crews of the victorious British ships as prize money. Small wonder, perhaps, that the 11-year-old Cuthbert Collingwood was drawn to the sea and its potential for heroics and glory. In 1761, at the age of 12, Collingwood entered the navy as a volunteer aboard a 28-gun frigate, the Shannon, whose commander, Captain Braithwaite, knew the family. Cuthbert Sr. paid £30 for him to be introduced to a society which, by today's standards, seems unbelievably harsh, brutal, dangerous and unpleasant. For Collingwood, of the 49 years left until his death, 44 would be spent at sea. He would have to get used to it.